From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is on the road today, continuing to try to undo the legacy of his predecessor. Trump is meeting with automakers in Detroit to announce a rollback of President Obama's fuel standards. And then he's on to Tennessee for a campaign-style rally to sell the Republican plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But the president may also just want to get out of Washington. There's the buzz over his leaked tax return. Last night, reporter David K. Johnston appeared on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC. With the return, Johnston said he received in the mail. It showed Trump wrote off $100 million in losses, reducing his federal tax bill in 2005. This morning, Johnston told Good Morning America there's still a lot to uncover.
We don't know who he's getting his revenue from. We don't know who his partners are or who he's done business with in foreign countries, and that could have major national security implications.
But Trump's defenders are saying the return, unlike others, shows that at least he paid taxes. Also today, top lawmakers said they saw no evidence of wiretapping at Trump Tower. There are more calls for answers about Russian involvement in the American election. Despite the cold, Washington is heating up. Let's bring in Washington Post political reporter Amber Phillips. Hi, Amber.
Hi, Robin.
And start with those tax returns. The White House said last night the publication of them was illegal. Both MSNBC and Johnston say it is not. But how valuable was that?
How valuable were the actual 2005 tax returns? Mm-hmm. And a portion of that, again, I repeat, we didn't get the whole tax return. Not that valuable to answer some of the hidden questions about Donald Trump's finances. What we learned is not that big of a deal politically for the president. We learned he paid taxes, millions of dollars of them in 2005. We learned his tax rate was lower than someone in his bracket typically would be, but that's likely because he took advantage of tools available to him to lower it, which is something he acknowledged he did during the campaign.
Well, critics of all the hoopla around the announcement said that the returns last night weren't as incendiary as the New York Times report that showed that President Trump, now President Trump, took advantage of laws allowing him to take other people's losses. This was in the 90s, and that meant he didn't pay taxes for years. And one thing the tax documents didn't show is any connection to Russia.
Yeah, we know is his income. It was something around $150 million that he had reported that year, and what he paid out in federal taxes, $38 million. We don't know the sources. That would come with more detailed information of his financial ties and his tax returns. But you're absolutely right. It leaves open major questions.
Yeah.
It also doesn't really explain why the president hasn't released his tax returns, because, as you said, this showed that he did pay taxes despite this really big loss, almost $1 billion he reported taking in the 90s that could have allowed him to not pay taxes for two decades.
Right.
Apparently, he did pay it at least one year. So there's so many unanswered questions surrounding his finances still.
Right. Well, and by the way, Donald Trump responded today with a tweet that said, "Does anybody really believe that a reporter who nobody ever heard of went to his mailbox and found my tax returns?" For the record, reporter David K. Johnston won a Pulitzer in 2001. And he and others are saying that this is exactly why we need to have more information. So some of those questions that can be answered. But meanwhile, the president is in Detroit today, where he's expected to announce the rollback of President Obama's fuel efficiency standards, the 2012 rules that required automakers to nearly double the efficiency of new cars and trucks by 2025. Automakers say they're too expensive. A nod to the industry on the part of President Trump. Can he do this, though?
Yeah, this is the prerogative of the administration to change its own regulations. And this isn't surprising that this is one of the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency that governs these fuel standards, that this is one of their first steps. It's an easy political win for the president, for him to be able to go to Michigan, a state that he won, and say, look, I'm saving you guys jobs by trying to lower these fuel standards so that it's easier to make cars and more people buy your cars.
Yeah.
The president of Ford has said that lowering these fuel standards, which hasn't happened yet, it's something the administration is considering doing, would save up to 1 million jobs. So this is an easy political win for him to at least start talking about it.
Well, he's also expected to ask the EPA to roll back President Obama's clean coal plan. That's next. But on to health care. There's a rally later today in Tennessee. President Trump got 61% of the vote in Tennessee. But then we're hearing, so many lawmakers in Congress, conservative Republicans, balking at the new Republican plan for for health care, and many saying that Donald Trump supporters are the ones who won't be able to afford it. Might we start seeing that skepticism show up at these rallies?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think states like Tennessee and even Kentucky are in a way ground zero for this healthcare debate. They're Trump states that went for the president very big in the presidential election. And yet they're states that have also expanded Medicaid and or have a lower income population that could benefit from expanded Medicaid. The Republican bill would roll back starting around 2020 expanded Medicaid. And that puts a lot of Republican Congress people in those states in a tough situation. On principle, right, they don't want these big government programs. They don't want to keep spending more and more money for health care. But they also have constituents who I think are starting to recognize that they could lose their health care because of this GOP plan.
Yeah. Another thing we're watching today, lawmakers in Washington really ramping up their call for proof that there was wiretapping by the Obama administration or the results of investigations into Russian interference in the American election. So we're keeping an eye on both those stories as well today. Washington Post political reporter Amber Phillips, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
More than 300,000 visitors are in Austin, Texas this week for the South by Southwest Festival. The annual event showcases music, film, and technology, and it's a proving ground for things like a badge holder's line endurance, a local's patience for visitors, and this year, the ability of non-Uber and non-Lyft ride-hailing apps to handle the increased demand. Audrey McGlinchey of Here and Now contributor KUT has our story about the biggest test yet for Austin's fledgling ride-hailing companies.
It's been 10 months since Uber and Lyft shut down their operations in Austin after the public voted to uphold city council rules mandating fingerprinting for drivers. Within days, alternatives cropped up. Fare from Phoenix, Fasten from Boston, and Ride Austin from, well, Austin. In total, there are 6 ride-hailing apps operating in the city. And since South by Southwest kicked off last week, I've been out on the streets asking one question. If you've been using ride-hailing, how have you been getting around?
I have been using Austin Ride.
Ride Austin?
Ride Austin. And it's really, I mean, it could not be easier.
I met Matt Wold of LA on Friday as he stood in line to pick up his festival badge. It was the first day of the event, and almost everyone I talked to had used Ride Austin or Fasten to get in from the airport. I heard few issues.
That's the least of my worries, is that there was no Lyft and no Uber.
That sentiment would change, and we'll get to that. First, a look at these newer companies' big tests and a big opportunity.
South by Southwest is an incredible platform to launch anything new, and it could mean to relaunch or go national where you might have been regional or local previously.
Harlan Beverly works at the University of Texas Venture Labs, which fosters startups. A decade ago, Twitter used South by Southwest to introduce itself to the world. So could an app like Fasten do the same? Beverly says to have a shot at the big time, they'd have to offer something different from Uber and Lyft, something that would make South by visitors want to use these new apps in their home cities.
These companies that are operating in Austin are operating because there's no Uber and Lyft. And if their Uber and Lyft were here, they'd have a real problem competing, which means that they're going to have a problem competing on a national stage unless they can be different and tackle more of the transportation industry than Uber and Lyft are currently doing.
There are a few differences. One app only offers scheduled rides. Another hails you a traditional cab. But most notably, these companies have demonstrated they're open to city regulations. Art Olbert is a tech investor in Austin.
Austin's not the only city who resisted some of the terms and conditions of the established players. And so that in itself could be a value proposition that the local players could use.
But of course, all of this is predicated on one thing, performing well. Because if you take the stage and you flop,
I'm literally going to throw this against the wall.
I found Mel Rowe and a friend on Sunday waiting in line for a South by Southwest party. Rowe says she nearly threw her phone at the wall Saturday night when the Fasten app wasn't working. Both Fasten and Ride Austin were down for several hours. Fasten says it saw nearly 12 times the number of requests it normally receives. It blames the rain and Ride Austin going down. Ride Austin blames their crash on a surge of requests after Fasten went down. We may never know which crash came first. What we do know is that Rowe and her her friend were stranded after they finished dinner.
So we ended up having to, like, stand on the street like it was 1995 to, like, get a freaking cab, and it drove us absolutely insane.
Another festival goer, Rachel Powell, was just as frustrated, but she and her friends had a different take.
We didn't have any ride shares, you know, 4 years ago. Like, complaining about it now was like, we, you know, we got really used to it real bad.
Both Ride Austin and Fasten say they fixed what caused their apps to go down over the weekend, and it remains to be seen how they'll fare for the remainder of the festival. Meanwhile, there are at least three ride-hailing bills working their way through the Texas legislature. Each of these, if passed, would override city regulations, paving the way for Uber and Lyft to return to Austin. For Here and Now, I'm Audrey McGlinchey.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrives in Tokyo tonight, kicking off his first official visit to Asia. He'll be visiting Japan, South Korea, and China. His trip comes at a volatile time for the region. Last week, North Korea carried out its second ballistic missile test in just a month, just as the U.S. deployed its own missile system across the border in South Korea. That's called Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD. Well, for more, we're joined now by Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh. Hi there, Jim.
Hi.
Okay, so first of all, it looks like, are we seeing a significant military buildup along the North and South Korea border?
Well, I would say yes, but this is something that started more than 10 years ago. Both sides, South Korea and North Korea, are looking to augment their forces and their capabilities. Some 7 years ago, going back to 2010, in the case of South Korea, since then it has massively improved its ability to hit targets throughout North Korea. It vies with Saudi Arabia to be the number one or number two arms buyer in the world. And of course, we certainly hear a lot recently about North Korea's tests. They are exploring every possible platform as well as their nuclear program.
But let's talk for another second about this latest ballistic missile test by North Korea. Does it signify a turning point, or how significant are they?
No, I mean, I think it means more progress. To put it into context, North Korea had more than 20 tests last year. So, it's no surprise they're testing, and no one should be surprised when they continue testing.
Are these regional ballistic missiles? Does it hint to ICBM capability?
No. It looks like it's a variant of the Scud, an intermediate range, or rather medium range missile that could be aimed at South Korea or Japan. Obviously, it came close to in some cases, Japanese waters. But it's not an ICBM. I know everyone focuses on intercontinental ballistic missiles as sort of the definition of threat. You know, when they have that, boy, that's when we really got to worry. I think that emphasis is misplaced. First of all, I think it's not going to happen for a while. They haven't even flight tested a reentry vehicle, and you can't have an ICBM without a reentry vehicle. And I see no signs of that happening. But more importantly, we have tens of thousands of American soldiers in South Korea, in Japan. Were North Korea to attack them with a nuclear weapon, I'm pretty sure we're going to think that that's an attack on the United States, and that constitutes war and would be a horrific outcome. So I think that day of is it time to start worrying about the situation? That time has already arrived, and we don't have to worry for an ICBM. Wait for an ICBM to do that.
Okay, Jim. So in that case, this U.S. deployed missile system in South Korea, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, based on what you said, it sounds like it's come along just in time.
Well, first of all, congratulations for saying that very difficult phrase twice and getting it right both times. Well, I guess it's what you make of it. Missile defenses tend to be designed for a particular missile type, maybe not so good against others. This is a system that has not been tested in wartime. I think, let me draw back and make the more general point. When I go across the U.S. and lecture or talk to media people, I get a sense that people think we have a magic answer, a magic defense to a nuclear attack. And we don't. We never have. That's the definition of the nuclear revolution. In the millennia that preceded 1945, defense, building a moat, a castle wall, whatever, seemed like a good idea. They call it a nuclear revolution because there is no defense against nuclear weapons. I just think we've been talking about missile defense for so long, people seem to believe it exists.
Okay, but yet this system has been deployed in South Korea, and the Chinese are not happy about it. I mean, I take your point.
Yes.
The Defense Department obviously differs because they put it out there.
Well, it can be for different purposes. It can be for reassurance if you think that's going to calm your ally down. It can be to make your adversary think that you have something you might be able to do. But again, yes, we have had THAAD now in South Korea, also Turkey and the United Arab Emirates. Never been used, right? designed for one thing. What happens if your adversary, has decoys or countermeasures? I don't think we should be putting our eggs in the missile defense basket when it comes to nuclear weapons.
Okay. I take your point, and yet we have to a certain degree.
Yes.
Never been used. Ideally, that's the point as well, to serve as a deterrent. Do you think it's effective at all as a deterrent against North Korea?
Well, this is a case where the North Koreans think they're deterring us, our so-called hostile policy, and that we want regime change. And we're saying we're deterring them because they do these terrible things and are threatening our allies. I don't think it's going to change North Korean behavior. And they're working on submarine launch missiles for which THAAD would do very little. China is concerned, to get back to your question, because that radar is going to go straight into China.
The radar used by the THAAD system.
Exactly. So imagine if the Chinese put a radar in Canada and looked at our missile silos in North Dakota. They're worried that this is the leading, bleeding edge and there'll be more advanced systems in the future, or they'll pick up data, the U.S. will have data that will put their system at risk. So they and the Russians are concerned about it.
All right. So in the last couple seconds we have, Jim, it occurs to me that we started this conversation noting that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is actually going to be in the region. South Korea has got a bit of a power vacuum right now because of an investigation into the president there. So what do you think Tillerson needs to do on this trip to reassure allies in the region?
I think he needs to act like a normal person, reassure our friends that we're normal and not crazy back here. We're going to take our time. We'll wait for the South Koreans to have their election. We're not going to act precipitously and go off and do something when our main ally doesn't have leadership. I think it's a very tenuous time in the region. We have a new president. They don't have a president. Kim Jong-un is acting in a very shocking way in some ways with that VX and withholding the Malaysians hostage, essentially. It's a very difficult time. I hope people slow it down, give everyone a chance to get their teams in place, and then think about the problem.
It's going to be hard to know if he does that or not, given that he's not taking a regular press pool with him. But Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, now to that big media moment last night. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow tweeting, "Breaking, we've got Trump tax returns. Seriously." And social media seriously caught fire. Then the show came, as Brooks Gladstone, co-host of NPR's On the Media, tweeted, "I'm afraid this is going to be Al Capone's vault," a reference to that big TV spectacular in which Geraldo Rivera opened a vault and we saw nothing. Rachel and her guest, reporter David K. Johnston of DCReport.org, who said he was the one who actually received the material in the mail, showed two pages of a 2005 tax return. Let's bring in NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, Rachel Maddow always does a terrific, frankly, context-filled 20-minute intro to her show. This time, many viewers thought she should have cut to the chase. Your thoughts?
Oh, it was so loaded, front-loaded with context. You felt like you were uncertain what text there might be, what actual meat there would be to the matter. And I think that was a disservice both to the nature of the issue and to the time of viewers, many of whom might have been tuning in to sample Maddow, given how much heat it generated in a short amount of time, as you say, on social media, and how much MSNBC itself was pumping it up. It's not to say there was nothing there, but there was a lot of throat clearing to an extent that I don't think aided the clarity of what she was trying to present.
And what do you think was there? These tax returns in 2005 showed Donald Trump earning $150 million that year and paying about a quarter of that in taxes.
Sure. I think that we did get some insight from this. I think it is useful to know about this. Why is it useful to know about this? It's because Trump is the first presidential major party nominee in decades and certainly president in decades to refuse to release his tax return. So you're trying to figure out how he made money, what might be personally important to him, with whom he might have been in business. There are all kinds of implications what we learned. We learned that, as the Times put it this morning, that Trump wrote off call it $100 million in losses. Mm-hmm. You learned that he paid a significant amount of taxes, but that was largely almost entirely because of the alternative minimum tax that was levied against him, something that he's seeking to diminish or eliminate. So there are a variety of insights that you can glean from these things. It's just, it felt a little bit like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain there for a while.
Well, but this isn't, her program is not a nightly news program or even, CNN in some ways. Talk a little bit about tone. When we finally hear from her, she noted that the White House issued a statement, important news, saying that the tax return was published illegally by fake news. Here's her response.
"For the record, the First Amendment gives us the right to publish this return. It is not illegally published, nor are we fake. Pinch me. I'm real."
Now, her many followers delight in Rachel Maddow's tone. But is there something about making something, I don't know, personal? Your thoughts on just the delivery of the information?
Look, Rachel Maddow is very smart. If I'm not mistaken, she has a doctorate, a PhD from Oxford, where she was a Rhodes Scholar. You know, she likes to give you the backdrop of this. I just think she poorly served it. I think this could have been two segments. And there's no need for them to try to do it all at once. This was fairly thinly sliced, bread, if you're thinking about what happens. That's not unfamiliar for cable news. And she's much more tethered to fact and research than a lot of her ideological rivals at different places. But that said, I think she's still responsible for what she did. I think she poorly served what she was trying to do. If you overhype a story, you can obscure what there's real in there. And I think there's some insight to be gleaned even from tax forms a dozen years ago, given the paucity of public information Trump has provided to the public and to the voters.
Well, and just to weigh in for a second, again, this is somebody who does an amazing amount of research and work in that opening that she has to her program. But this came at a time, this hoopla, this hype, came at a time when the press is, you know, back on its heels, the mainstream press. Does this, I mean, what you're seeing today in social media is many on the right, Donald Trump supporters, Breitbart readers saying, see, there's hype from Rachel Maddow as well. Does this also infect regular mainstream media?
You know, look, I think that Trump was willing to attack the idea that, as we heard from Rachel Maddow, that somehow this was legal. It's legal for them to do it as long as they haven't solicited an illegal act to obtain it. And in fact, their guest, David Johnston, had it, he said, sent over the transom. He speculated by people allied with Trump or the president himself to distract from other issues. I think that you're seeing an attack by Breitbart. You're seeing an attack from Fox News, which is feeling its ratings under pinch. Rachel Maddow has done very well of late. But, you know, I think she would better serve her argument and what she's scrutinizing by tempering it and presenting it with the attention it deserves. It wasn't worth a full show special. It certainly wasn't.
David Fogelflick, thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
People with cystic fibrosis are living longer than they used to, as doctors have found better ways to treat the disease. But a study out this week finds that people in Canada who suffer from cystic fibrosis are living, on average, 10 years longer than people in the U.S. For more now on why that is, Eric Budman joins us. He's a reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. It's good to have you back, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me.
So 10 years longer in Canada, why?
The study doesn't technically say why, but they put forth three hypotheses that are pretty compelling.
And the most compelling one to you?
The most compelling reason is the differences in health insurance in each country.
Meaning that Canadians all have access to national health insurance?
Yes. And there was no difference in the risk of death between Canadians and Americans who are on private insurance. But when you look at those Americans who are on Medicare and Medicaid, they are more likely to die. So their risk of death is higher than Canadians. And that gap is even greater for Americans who are uninsured.
Okay. So basically, it's access to care and the kind of care that you have access to that matters here. Beyond insurance, we can come back to insurance in a second, but beyond insurance,
sure.
Were they tracking folks with milder forms of cystic fibrosis that might have skewed their data a little bit?
So they actually took that into account. That was, in some ways, the impetus for this study, because they first noticed this gap in 2011, and they thought, well, we better control for any possible demographic differences. But they did have two other hypotheses, as to why this gap might exist. And one has to do with a high-fat diet that was implemented in Canada before it was in the U.S. and that turns out to confer some survival advantage. And another is that Canadians with cystic fibrosis tend to have better access to lung transplants than Americans.
Right. And of course, the lungs are under attack, a severe attack in patients who suffer from cystic fibrosis. So let's come full circle here, because it seems like it comes back down to quality and access to care. I mean, that seems to be a very logical conclusion. So what conclusions or lessons do the researchers draw from this?
I mean, it's maybe not all that surprising, but the better access to care you have, the more likely you are to survive with a deadly disease. And some of the researchers pointed out that right now it's important to be expanding access to care as opposed to cutting back on access to care.
I'm curious, were there major ways that treatment in Canada differs from the United States? I mean, are we saying that because of Canada's system of national health that people suffering from cystic fibrosis were able to get medical care earlier and more consistently?
So it looks like Americans are actually, on average, diagnosed earlier. And so it is sort of this conundrum that's going on.
So, I mean, in other words, Americans are getting diagnosed earlier, but it's a real patchwork in terms of how much their insurance, if they have it, is going to pay for the care they need.
Yeah. Although this study, you know, it's really a first step and it can't explain all of the differences in the access to care.
I see. But we are seeing a major difference, though, in life expectancies. I mean, a decade is enormous.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest survival gaps that's seen between Canada and the United States. Even researchers who've seen similar trends say that this is stunning.
Well, Eric Budman is a reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Eric, many thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for speaking with me.
All this week, we're taking a closer look at health care and the many parts up for debate as Republicans move to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Today's conversation on mandates or requirements was inspired by this recent exchange at a hearing. It's between Congressman Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania, a Democrat, and Illinois Congressman John Shimkus, a Republican. It starts with Doyle, the Democrat.
What mandate in the Obamacare bill does he take issue with? Certainly not with pre-existing conditions or caps on benefits or letting your child stay on the policy to 26. So I'm curious, what is it we're mandating?
Would the gentleman yield?
Yeah, sure.
What about men having to purchase prenatal care? Is that not correct?
Reclaiming my time.
And should they?
Reclaiming my time.
Whoa.
There's no such thing as a la
carte. Regular order.
There's no such thing as a la carte insurance, John. You don't get the.
That's the point. That's
say,
the point.
That.
We want the consumer to be able to go to the insurance market and be able to negotiate on a plan.
Reclaiming my time. You tell me what insurance company will do that. There isn't a single insurance company in the world
that
does that, John. You're talking about something that doesn't exist.
Well, I'm going to reclaim my time right now. Let's bring in Sarah Cliff. She covers health policy for Vox.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's unpack what we just heard. We want to talk about mandates, but not initially the mandate everyone thinks of to buy coverage or pay a fee. These other requirements within Obamacare, we heard some of them, letting your child stay on the policy to 26. Now, we just heard that Congressman Shimkus asked about men having to, are men going to have to purchase prenatal care? People don't specifically purchase pieces of care, do they?
No, that's, you know, insurance wouldn't really work if all of us could say, well, I want coverage for my particular disease, but I don't want to pay for the other things. The way health insurance works is you're kind of spreading the costs of all of our health care, all of our very different needs across a large group of people. And that's essentially what is going on with maternity care in the individual market right now, that everyone is required to purchase it, as the congressman was suggesting. If you didn't have that requirement, it would be very hard to get maternity services if you were someone who needed them. The National Women's Law Center, they found before Obamacare, just 12% of plans on the individual market would cover maternity care. And it is it's a big policy debate. Having insurers required to cover maternity care, it does raise premiums a little bit for everybody. But saying that it's okay not to cover it means that women who do use the individual market and who do want to get pregnant, they are going to have to pay a very steep fee to get insurance that would cover their pregnancy.
Well, and again, this was before Obamacare. Not only pay a steep fee, there'd be a required waiting period, sometimes a year or longer. Look, this goes to the heart of what Obamacare did. It required insurers to – it's not that people are required to buy certain things. It's that insurers are required to package them in their coverage, if I've got this right. And this is at least 10 essential health benefits. They include maternity care and hospitalization, prescription drugs. Run through the rest of them.
Yeah, we also have in there, there's a few things that, you know, weren't frequently covered in the individual market before Obamacare. Mental health services, for example, or rehabilitative services, long-term care are in that package. And that package has really been a sticking point in the debate about Obamacare repeal and replace. You know, the drafters of Obamacare, they really, like you said, they wanted to standardize health insurance. They wanted it to be that when you go into the market and you buy this product, you knew what you were getting. Before the Affordable Care Act, there wasn't a lot of standardization in the individual market. It could be really hard to tell, and you'd have to go through a lot of fine print to find out what your benefits actually covered. So Obamacare standardized it, said every insurance plan has to offer these benefits. That drives up the cost of insurance. When you make health insurance more robust, the premiums get more expensive because the insurance plan is paying for more services. Yeah. So there's, you know, a constant trade-off there about what you want to require and what you want to ask people to pay for in premiums.
They include lab services, preventive and wellness services, chronic disease management, pediatric services, including oral and vision care. These are some of those 10 requirements that be in packages that are sold. By the way, we should mention Seema Verma, who is President Trump's head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also said in her confirmation hearings that maternity benefits should be optional in those health plans. So this debate, which is an old debate, is being reactivated. And again, the thinking of including these requirements or mandates is that your money is fungible. While some single men who don't have children, or single women for that case, may be paying for some maternity care, women are paying for prostate screenings that they are not using. So the Republicans don't have enough votes to just completely change the law, Obamacare. But it's been said that they can, the phrase it's sometimes used is skinny up some of these requirements. Are they skinnying up the requirement for maternity care or prescription drugs?
So they haven't taken any action on that yet. Republicans would like to end this essential health benefit package. Every proposal I saw in the lead up to the American Health Care Act, their new replacement bill, said the essential health benefits go, insurers, you get to decide what is covered. The challenge is they are trying to use this kind of arcane Senate process called reconciliation to pass their bill. It is a good process for Republicans because they only need a simple majority in the Senate. They don't have to get to the 60-member filibuster-proof majority. But it is also a bad method because everything they do has to relate directly to the federal budget. And it would be very hard to make the argument that re-regulating the insurance industry is somehow a budgetary action. So when we saw the American Healthcare Act come out, it was actually a bit surprising. They said, you know what, we're not going to re-regulate the essential health benefits through this bill. We don't think we have the authority to do that. What you might see is some regulatory action from Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, Medicare Administrator Seema Verma, that they might do a few things to lessen the essential health benefits through the different regulations they put out. It's not entirely clear how they would do that. Those 10 categories we were talking about earlier, they are written into law. They are part of the Affordable Care Act. So that makes it a little harder to tackle this in a regulatory way. But one required benefit that you could tackle through regulations is the birth control mandate. Mm-hmm. There's no language in the Affordable Care Act that says all insurers have to cover birth control without copay. That was completely done through regulations of the Obama administration. So that's a mandate they could tackle very easily and without any help from Congress.
Because, again, it's not in the law. It's a regulation, this requirement that insurers cover birth control with copay, with some religious exceptions. Listen, you said that it raised some of the premiums to make these requirements. Did it lower costs elsewhere? You know, I'm just wondering, some of them, for instance, rehabilitative and habilitative services. Habilitative services are for, you know, people who have ongoing autism, for instance. Did requiring coverage of some of these lessen costs elsewhere.
That's really tricky to measure. It's a great point about when you invest in these kind of preventative services, you know, ranging from habilitative services, prenatal care, that you can see dividends elsewhere. But it can be really hard to measure, and it usually doesn't get paid back to the insurance company. This is, you know, one reason we all talk about prevention saving money, but often those savings are so far down the line that it doesn't really actually recoup to the person who is paying for the preventive care up front. But I think prenatal care is a good example of this, that if you're having healthier pregnancies, it's pretty reasonable to assume you're going to have better outcomes and maybe cheaper care for that baby when it's born. It's really difficult to measure. There is a little bit of research on the birth control mandate, for example, that suggests that does save money. When more people are preventing pregnancies, when they're taking contraceptives regularly, insurance premiums, there's decent research suggesting they'll go down because you'll have less unintended pregnancies. But it's a tricky area to measure.
And just to be clear, this idea of buying a la carte, buying just the insurance that you want, just cover me for, I might have a knee problem, but I don't want other stuff. Is it just the idea that it's all fungible? I mean, it's like requiring the mandate under Obamacare that everybody buy it, not just the people who are sick, the healthy people kick in as well. Is it the same thinking?
It's a little bit similar. It kind of is a very different theory of insurance, that you should be able to pick and choose the benefits. And it's a little hard to see how that works, because, you know, one of the ideas of packaging all these benefits together some people will use them, some people won't. When everyone gets to pick their benefits, the premiums are going to be very high, because you can assume all the people with knee problems are choosing the knee plan.
Right. Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for Vox, as we try to continue to pick away at the health debate. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Girl Guides of Canada have canceled a nationally sponsored trip to California over concerns that members of the group could be refused at the border because of the Trump administration's travel restrictions. According to Global Business Travel Association, $185 million in business travel bookings were lost the week following the first executive order on immigration signed back in January. That one restricted travel from to the U.S. from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Mike McCormick is the executive editor and COO of the Global Business Travel Association. He joins us via Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, that $185 million, how did you come up with that figure?
Well, we went to our industry sources looking at the data that was available, and bookings across the system for business travel in the United States were up 1.2% in the week before the first executive order was issued. And in the week following, they dropped 2.2%. There would be no other reason for that sort of precipitous drop in the bookings. It was a 3.4% swing in bookings during that time period, which equates to about $185 million worth of business travel bookings.
Interesting. So is that, do you and your group consider that a large swing in a short period of time, given how large the business travel industry in the United States is overall?
Yeah, very much so. And again, there would be no other reason for that type of change during that period. And again, with the first executive order, it was so broad and affecting green card holders and affecting, obviously, the 7 countries that were named. Business travel, by the way, just to those 7 countries reduced about 43% during that same time period. So you had a real dramatic effect, obviously, on those countries, but a much broader one with all the uncertainty that was created.
Now, give us a sense about how large the business travel industry is in the United States.
Well, the overall business travel industry is significant, and it has a huge impact and drives growth overall. So just in our membership for GBTA, we represent about $350 billion worth of business travel bookings, and we represent, you know, a significant portion of the overall business travel industry. But when you're talking about these types of factors around uncertainty for business travel, you know, for every 1% shift in business travel here in the United States, you're talking about impacting over 71,000 jobs, about $5 billion worth of GNP. It makes a real significant impact, travel does, on overall business and the economy.
Now, of course, as we're talking, you you concentrate more on business travel. But we were also looking at the digital travel agency Hopper, and they were reporting that interest, just sheer interest in flying to the United States, was down 17% during a period of 3 weeks before President Trump was inaugurated and 2 weeks afterwards. So a total of 5 weeks they were looking at there. I'm just wondering, do you have a lot of contacts or conversations with members of the international business community? I mean, what are you hearing from people about specifically why they say they may not be as interested in coming here anymore?
Well, we surveyed our members, the people who, you know, basically are responsible for business travel buying, for example, in Europe, and looking at the impact all of this has had on them and on perception of U.S. And, you know, I would say that there's certainly an impact when things like this happen, more relatively in the short term. But business has to go on. Business travel is highly resilient. The more concerning number for us is when we polled our members in Europe and asked them about impact on business travel, where groups and meetings and events are concerned, over 40% of them said that it was going to significantly or at least marginally impact their decisions about group and meeting travel in the future, and meaning that they weren't going to come to the U.S. Because when you're planning a meeting or planning an event of some kind, you have options other than coming to the United States. You can choose other destinations and other cities to have those same meetings. So in this case, the longer impact of this uncertainty and of this overall kind of feeling that we're tightening our borders and we're closed for business really can have a longer-term impact that will be significant to business travel.
Now, have you heard from airlines or hotel companies? Because business travel is obviously a major revenue stream for those industries as well.
Yeah, so the airlines to date have said that they've seen basically a negligible impact. And I would suspect that in the short term, that would be the case, because even taking that $185 million worth of bookings and spreading it across all airlines, across all vendors, you know, they might see some impact, but it might be more negligible. I have heard from hoteliers that they're seeing a 20, 30, 40% declines in bookings at their hotels, depending on the markets they serve.
Well, Mike McCormick is the Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of the Global Business Travel Association. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.